The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. If you listen to NHPR regularly, you've probably heard this.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations. From the estate of Joan B. Kroc, whose bequest serves as an enduring investment in the future of public radio and seeks to help NPR produce programming that meets the highest standards of public service in journalism and cultural expression.
Joan Kroc famously made a $225 million bequest to NPR upon her death in 2003, perhaps best known as the wife of Ray Kroc, the billionaire entrepreneur behind the McDonald's franchise. Joan Kroc paved her own way as a philanthropist, donating generously to causes that would likely have made her late husband cringe. The couple is the subject of Lisa Napoli's new book, Ray and Joan, The Man Who Made the McDonald's Fortune and the Woman Who Gave It All Away. Lisa Napoli, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me here.
So where did all this start for you, this Kroc fascination?
It didn't start because I eat McDonald's. It started partially because I'm a public radio reporter. And so, of course, I wondered when I heard that name every day, why? But more specifically, there was a public artwork here in Southern California, where I live, that was in disrepair, in need of costly repairs. And it turns out that Joan Kroc had anonymously funded this sculpture many years ago. And when I went to cover the story for a local radio station here, I thought, well, that's odd. You know, she gave all this money to public radio and she funded this peace sculpture of a nuclear mushroom cloud. That seemed odd and disparate, and given that she didn't live here, I really was curious and I couldn't find a biography, so I decided to write one.
So you took on this couple, this powerful couple, and learned, and maybe a lot of people have heard this, that Joan Kroc also gave another posthumous gift, $2 billion, to the Salvation Army.
Yes.
Was she religious, or what was that connection?
No, and that's what's so interesting, Virginia. The more I found about her giving, the more piecemeal it seemed. You know, a lot of people, when they give money, give it all in one place or in one cause, and they're very directed about it. But Joan wasn't that way. And so when I found that this gift to the Salvation Army that funded recreation centers that were to be built all across the country happened, and that Joan was not a Salvationist, then I found more about her peace giving that had to do with two major Catholic universities where she'd built these beautiful peace centers. And I just kept going down that rabbit hole and getting more and more intrigued because it didn't add up to make any sense. And, you know, naively, even though I'd written a book before, I had no idea how impossibly hard it was going to be to find out more about her, partially because she didn't leave a trail the way many philanthropists or business people do. And McDonald's wasn't willing to work with me, so that made the task even more challenging.
Well, you did find out a lot about her. She was brought up in a poor household in Minnesota. Now, how did she meet Ray?
That's also very interesting. It turns out that Joan was Ray's third wife. She was 26 years younger, and she met Ray when he walked into a restaurant where she was playing organ to entertain the diners in this very fancy place called the Criterion. And Ray walked in to sell her boss a franchise of McDonald's. This was in the very, very early days when Ray had just signed on to sell franchises for the Brothers McDonald, who operated out of San Bernardino, California. Ray had become dazzled with their formula and was on the road trying to replicate it around the country, and Joan's boss was one of the early buyers. He opened store number 93, in fact.
So on the surface, third wife, 26 years younger, playing organ at a restaurant. Was he a wealthy man when they met?
No, in fact, he was far from a wealthy man, and McDonald's was far from successful. It was a time in America, the post-World War landscape, as the roads were being paved out to the suburbs that were developing, and fast food was becoming a thing. McDonald's was not the only propagator of fast food, and it was a really exciting and interesting time, but Ray was far from wealthy, and McDonald's was actually in a precarious situation, even though the first one was super successful. Back in California, as Ray was selling these franchises around the country, he was quickly finding out that the franchise formula he had was not super ironclad. And yes, it's very easy to look at Joan and think, wow, you know, she saw this man who was a dashing businessman and sparks flew. But really, honestly, it took them years before they married. And once they did marry, Ray was enormously wealthy. But Joan's first husband had become quite well off himself, building McDonald's of his own.
Hmm. So it was actually 12 years before between that meeting time and they actually married. Was it a happy marriage?
It was a very complicated marriage, Virginia, as many marriages are. Ray was a drinker. And what was interesting about that is that Joan was very troubled by his drinking and his aggressive behavior when he drank. And instead of divorcing him, she decided to stay in the marriage and turn her pain from dealing with living with an alcoholic into something that turned out to be very useful and instructive for other people in a similar situation all around the country. And that, to me, was a really telling indicator about her, that it wasn't just about her. She wanted to find a way to help other people who were suffering.
And she did. Was this the beginning of her philanthropic work?
It was. She had given some gifts before that, especially once she married Ray and had access to his fortune. But this was her real entree into the philanthropic world. And it was very exciting because it was a time before we talked about alcoholism publicly in a common sense, the way we do today. And rehab facilities all around the country were developing and coming up with new and interesting techniques. And Joan was able to coalesce this burgeoning movement of rehab experts, both because she had the money and the interest, but she took them too and made movies and popular culture books. She got Dear Abby to write about a pamphlet that she produced. And she wanted to reach the people, not just the educators. And that really also was a very interesting indicator for me about her personality, too.
When was this?
So this was in the 70s, and this is at the height of Ray's popularity. And what's also interesting here is that while Joan was being trotted around on a press tour, it was very very pointed that Joan not discuss Ray's problems, Ray's afflictions. And at around this time, he got invited to New Hampshire, to Dartmouth. Now, neither Ray nor Joan had gone to college, but Ray, because he was such a popular businessman, was invited to the Tuck School to speak about his success and how he'd turned McDonald's into what it had become. And meanwhile, Joan went along with him on one of the trips when he spoke to the students there and sort of muscled her way in to Tuck's hope that Ray would give money to them. And instead, she developed a partnership with the medical school and ended up working with the medical school for many, many years on her alcoholism education program.
My guest is Lisa Napoli, the author of Ray and Joan. It's about the life and the philanthropy of Joan Kroc, wife of billionaire entrepreneur Ray Kroc, who made his fortune as owner of the McDonald's franchise. Ray was politically conservative. I would say even staunchly conservative. That was my impression from your book. He died in 1984. Did the focus of her philanthropy change after his death?
Yes, almost immediately after Ray passed away, she shifted gears. She did for a while continue to fund places like Betty Ford and Hazelden, preeminent rehab facilities. But really her shift went toward the peace movement. And that's where that peace sculpture that got me interested in all of this came about. She got involved with Norman Cousins, who was a preeminent thinker of his day and the founder of and the editor of the Saturday Review, and started funding research that he was doing into the mind and body connection. That was that was revolutionary for the time, the idea that your physical state was impacted by your mental state. She got really involved with hospice after Ray had passed away and her father with hospice care. She had met a doctor on a plane who was very interested in building the first freestanding hospice in San Diego, where they lived at the end of their lives. And she just funded the hospice anonymously. So she had a wide-ranging interest in so many different things. And once Ray was gone, she just followed that with abandon.
How do you think he would have felt about her philanthropy towards these causes for peace? You know, NPR, the Salvation Army, even hospice is considered controversial by some, especially religious conservatives.
You know, what's interesting is the paradoxes here with the Crocs. While Joan was convening all of these rehab folk in her and Dartmouth Medical School folk in her home in Santa Ynez, California, during this movement called Operation Cork, as she called it, Ray would be there with a cocktail in hand, participating in the discussions. So it's hard to know how he would react to the things that she did once he did pass away, because even though they did seem discordant with his political views, and he wasn't a religious person, and he was very skeptical of traditional education and many, many of the things that she funded, it's really hard to say, because he just adored her so much, even though he wasn't willing to come out as an alcoholic until the very end of his life, to acknowledge that he had a problem, he supported Joan. So it's what kept me interested in this couple for so many years, all the research that I had to do, because a lot of it just doesn't add up or make much sense.
And you mentioned that McDonald's did not work with you on this. I understand that a number of people there, you know, were not particularly happy about her helping the Democratic Party or nuclear disarmament or AIDS research, even thinking in some ways that she did it to get under his skin, back at him?
Right, which I think is just incredibly sexist, actually. I mean, he left her his money and with no agenda or strings attached, and she did with it what she felt was important and good. A lot of the old guard McDonald's guys were guys. It was a very Mad Men era at that time, the 60s and 70s. And I think the idea that this woman came along and swooped in and interrupted what he had been doing with philanthropy, his brother was guiding his philanthropic charity while he was still alive. I think there's just an air of sexism and maybe even some envy, because she got to make her mark in such a large way and in such an individual way.
She sounds like a feminist. I mean, would she say that? Did she see herself as that?
I don't think she ever identified herself as a feminist, but she certainly was. Everything about her, she funded the first conference of women who came together in Washington, D.C. to discuss the menace of nuclear weapons. She loved strong women, educated women, the woman with the hospice, the woman who ran the Salvation Army when she was giving them money, a woman who was a pioneering doctor working with AIDS patients. I think she just really loved that women could do things that she wasn't able to do as a woman of her age and her means in the contemporary times. And she wanted to support that in every way she could, not to the exclusion of supporting men. But if all that doesn't add up to being a feminist, I don't know what is.
Well, Lisa, I'm so glad you followed that curiosity from the Peace Monument to this book. Thanks so much for telling us about it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lisa Napoli, she's a journalist and author of Ray and Joan, The Man Who Made the McDonald's Fortune and the Woman Who Gave It All Away. There's a link to find more on the book at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Fake news travels fast. Even the most outrageous stories seem somehow more believable and clickable when passed along or posted by someone you know and trust. And the results can be devastating, as evidenced by yesterday's shooting at a Washington, D.C. pizzeria, which was targeted by a man with an assault rifle investigating a fake news story about a child sex ring supposedly run by Hillary Clinton and her campaign chief. After the election, Melissa Zimdars, assistant professor of communication and media at Merrimack College, started compiling a Google Doc of news sites that weren't trustworthy. She posted the list on Facebook, and it quickly went viral and kicked up a storm and attacks against her and became a source for accusations against Facebook and Google. Melissa Zimdars, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having me.
Well, who knew? Did you have any idea what you were starting here?
I had absolutely no idea. I thought it would be a useful teaching resource for my class and that some other educators or librarians could use it who I'm friends with on Facebook, but I never anticipated something like this spreading so widely.
Where do your students get their news?
Most of them get their news from Facebook. So we've talked throughout the semester about this, and that's their primary way of getting information. None of them read newspapers or, they might click through to them, but they don't watch the nightly news. They don't really turn to any traditional sources of journalism.
You started this list with about 130 sites that you called untrustworthy. Now it's become a larger collaboration, many more sites added. But how do you define untrustworthy?
So it's not that they're all untrustworthy. So part of it was helping my students navigate between different kinds of websites, whether completely fake, sometimes false or misleading, even generally trustworthy sites, but that rely on clickbait headlines, which can spread sensational bits of information, or even satirical news sources that some people don't realize is satirical and they circulate it as actual news.
So did you discover any kind of patterns about what kinds of things get people to click on them?
I feel like it tends to be very sensational pieces. So ones that people read and immediately have sort of an affective and emotional response to them. And that's precisely why even a lot of mainstream journalists, like the New York Times has been accused at times of using clickbait, or the Boston Globe and lots of other sources. And I understand why, because they're in a very competitive market. So I think that's the thing, like the ones that use really exaggerated language, like so-and-so will destroy this other person, or wow, you won't believe it. That kind of stuff piques the interest and gets people to click.
Right. You do also provide a guide for helping news consumers, discover and understand fake news. But what I found really interesting here was this is not just very fringy stuff that's put up to absolutely shock, but a number of sites disguised as legitimate news sites.
Yeah, that's true. And I think a lot of them, the problem isn't that they're not relaying important information, but rather that opinion or other kinds of misleading information are packaged as fact. So when it appears to be straight reporting, and yet it's either secondary reporting that can get diluted just like a game of telephone, or it's decontextualized in order to make a point, that's the kind of stuff that I'm also concerned with, in addition to just outright fake news.
After the election, the fake news site 70news.com published a story claiming, falsely, that Trump had actually won the popular vote, not Hillary Clinton. Now, because so many people saw it, it appeared prominently in Google search results for final election results. Now, so it speaks to a couple of different things. First, that the news was out there, but how it spreads. How did Google and Facebook, for example, benefit from this kind of fake news?
So Google obviously benefits in terms of advertising revenue, as does Facebook. And so that's one of the things they're both altering, even impacting their own revenue stream to potentially stymie the circulation of false information. And I think something like that spread very quickly because it spoke to a population that really wanted that to be true, right? And I think that's the point with a lot of fake news. Regardless of whether people perceive it to be fake or not, they potentially want it to be true, right? And that matters more than its actual veracity.
Do we know who's behind 70news.wordpress.com, for example?
I don't know who's behind that one yet, but I was digging a little bit because they wrote a false piece about me and the resource, actually, after being listed on it. But I haven't really been able to find much information about the writer.
Well, I've seen plenty of things about you, lists or articles, you know, calling you a leftist, a feminist professor who specialized in fat studies. I'm guessing that's women's studies. That list went viral, and it was faked. Your list was faked. People added or subtracted whatever they chose.
Yes, and claims about my personal politics, like some of it's true, some of it saying I'm a communist, I'm whatever. I'm like, I have no idea where they're getting this from. But part of the reason I put sites across the political spectrum on my resource is because my students wouldn't be receptive to something that was only conservative or only liberal. And this is a problem to me that expands the political spectrum. And it's something we should all be concerned about, regardless of our own political orientation.
Melissa Zimdar, she's assistant professor of communication and media at Merrimack College. It was she who started compiling a list of news sites that didn't seem trustworthy that went hyper viral online. Melissa, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. What do you imagine when you think of the future? Jetpacks? Teleporting? In a new collection of short stories set in the near future, writer Alexander Weinstein follows the human drive for instant connection, technological gratification, and environmental degradation to unsettling extremes. A family grieves the loss of a lifelike android son and big brother. Tourists flock to Nepal to download synthetic enlightenment at bargain prices. Fantasy partners and downloadable memories are customized for individual desires. And in an American heartland stripped of its topsoil, farmers contemplate turning their children into commodities. These stories prevent a future that is disquieting in its probability. Alexander Weinstein is director of the Martha's Vineyard Institute of Creative Writing and author of the collection. It's called Children of the New World. And Alexander Weinstein, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, you have to build worlds for each of these stories. And we do get some references to time or events like back in the 20s or after the big thaw. Did you imagine them all together in some vague future or one by one?
Well, they came to me one by one. Each story I created in that way. And then as I put the collection together, I started looking at pretty much like what is the time frame of this and how does it work? And so I lined up the collection consecutively. So the first story is close to where we are, right? There's robots, and the second story has people selling off their topsoil, which is kind of close to selling land rights for fracking and things like that. So that's close to where we are now. And then we move further and further away. Probably the most distant one is the pyramid story, where you have the U.S. government has figured out reincarnation and cloned bodies. And because of that, George W. Bush has been president for the last 10 incarnations. So that's probably the furthest out there.
And there are Buddhist terrorists who are trying to get back. You know, the process of reincarnation has been monetized.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and they're not even really terrorists. It's just that's how the U.S. presents them. They're just trying to say, you know, please stop messing with reincarnation.
Well, it's the attachment to our gadgets that runs through many of these stories. You mentioned that first story, saying goodbye to Yang. You know, plausible. We do have robots. But there's a young couple struggling with the system breakdown of Yang. This is a very realistic robotic big brother for their adopted Chinese daughter. So what was behind this for you?
Well, it came about, that was the first story that launched all the other stories in many ways. I had not been writing in this genre of speculative fiction until that story. And what happened was my laptop crashed and it took all of it, my work with it, all of the creative work. And I found myself incredibly distraught. I think I even cried over my laptop breaking down. And that disturbed me. I said, why am I crying over this equipment, right? Around the same time, my students were all getting smartphones and iPhones, and they were talking about how much they loved their smartphones, and God forbid they ever lose their smartphones. You know, they'd probably trade distant family members before their phones. And that made me realize, okay, we are starting to forge emotional connections much more deeply than we ever have with electronics. And that's then, that became Yang. My laptop became Yang. And then that started me on many of the other stories in there.
at one point, the father in this story says, "I slipped into thinking Yang was my son." And there's a lot of confusion here in these stories about what is real and what is not real. Do you see that happening around you?
Yeah, I think in many ways we do that all the time. I've been thinking a lot about hypothetical Facebook friends recently, the way that we have all these friends online that, and they're distant acquaintances sometimes. We went to high school, you know, who knows what, but that we never talk to them in actual, we don't pick up the phone and speak with them, we don't visit them. And yet we know that they just planted flowers in their garden, or they had a child, or they got married. And we like that or wish them well. But the real proof in the pudding is, like, when you are in that town, do they make the time to visit you, right? Mm-hmm. Or vice versa. And in that way, I think there is this kind of virtual friendship which doesn't really have a basis. It has a memory to a basis. But in actuality, it's really us just clicking likes and writing things on a screen. And that can happen even in text messaging. Recently, as I've been doing my book tour, I've been asking people, do you still call people? And the number of hands is decreasing of people that call rather than text.
You're reminding me of speaking with Sherry Turkle. Do you know her from MIT?
Sure, yeah.
So a very early proponent of, you know, the internet will change everything. It'll equalize everything. And now she's saying she's watching her young daughter and thinking that we have all of this kind of illusion of closeness without any of the real demands of friendship.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I agree. And I was really happy to see how her thinking around this changed. I remember her early work. And I just think she's really on top of where we're heading now in this sort of false intimacy that can get created. And I mean, to that extent, I think a lot about online dating apps and all of this kind of stuff where people are swiping people into the trash that they don't like based on their preferences, right? This is the sort of technology. And I think the technology teaches us, in this case, a lack of empathy, a lack of compassion, certainly more narcissism around wanting all our preferences met at every moment of the day.
But you're also reminding me of another story, migration. There's a college professor who's never met his students. He puts on a rubber suit and goggles to have a sexual relationship with an avatar of one of his young female students. His wife is having a similar relationship with a Latino gardener, you know, prone to not wearing a shirt. Now, for him, in his mind, this is cheating. For his wife, who's younger than he, it is not cheating. Why not?
Yeah, I mean, I wonder where I stand on that, you know, the sort of conversation of ethical non-monogamy that they're trying to forge. And so for her, I think what she's saying is really these are just, you know, avatars. They're not real people. That real cheating would only exist if we actually were in physical contact with them, not this virtual contact, which I think is ultimately a mildly flimsy, you know, rationale of that. But she's more open-minded about it. I think she's really kind of saying, it's okay, we can have an open relationship. It's just going to be technological. What I haven't explored, but what your question brings up, is how would she feel about an actual affair with a real human being? Would she be as open-minded about it? And then, of course, the husband is freaked out about this, but he's also very attracted to this student who he has no clue who's controlling that avatar. But in both of those cases, I think what they are attracted to or what they're interested in are these virtual projections. Hmm. And then there's a way that they're saying, well, they're just virtual projections. So really, they're just fantasies, right? This is no different than coming up with a fantasy and getting turned on by that. And whether, again, whether or not I agree or disagree, I think for these characters, they find themselves in a world where they have yet to navigate the ethics and the emotions that this new technology brings them, which is very akin to where I think we find ourselves, mm-hmm. where technology moves so fast and we've yet to really understand where our ground is underneath all of that.
Yeah, we haven't caught up. And in her case, you know, this is normalized. She lost her virginity online in middle school, you know, that this is how it happens, where he's sort of thinking back to the days of Tinder.
But exactly.
I want to dig into that more, this kind of idea of projections or fantasies. There's another story, cartographers. There's the man who works in a firm that manufactures synthetic memories. So if you can't make it to church, you can beam down the memory of a church sermon, or rappers can download memories of gunfights, or artists can, you know, take on the memories of a heroin addict. And I can imagine hearing about something like this and thinking, wow, that's really creepy. Wow, that's really cool. I mean, would you do that if you could download someone else's memories?
I'd like to say no, right? But here's the, for me,
could
one of the
really
things.
Could be really good as a writer.
It could be really good as a writer. Exactly right. I could just have all of Kafka's memories, you know, downloaded. The real question for me is, let's say there was a memory or a kind of consciousness expanding program where you put it in and suddenly you had universal love, right? Or you had, you know, real deep compassion. Would one do that, right? Wouldn't that be a beneficial thing? And I think it would be, right? It would be wonderful to send universal compassion downloads to the president-elect right now, for example, see what happens. But here's the danger of that. I think then we'll become addicted, as the story progresses, the character becomes addicted to memories, to our devices, that they should provide us that ability, right? So there's a way that I think our devices, or in this case, those downloadable memories, disempower the character's belief in their own ability to have memories and create memories, which, is, of course, is the critique that his girlfriend is saying. She's saying, you're not making real memories with me. You're just, you know, you don't even know what memories you have. And she's 100% right. That said, I mean, I think about my students, and I think if they could download or beam the homework assignments and the readings, you know, in 2 seconds, 90% of them would. Right. So as for me, would I do that? No, I don't. I hope not. But then again, I probably would try it once just to see. And that's the slippery slope, kind of like how I used to say, no, I don't want an iPhone. You know, I don't want to be on my phone all the time. And then eventually I thought, OK, let me try. It looks kind of cool. And now I'm on my iPhone all the time.
We're speaking with Alexander Weinstein. He's the director of Martha's Vineyard Institute of Creative Writing and author of the new short story collection called Children of the New World. This book is dedicated to, I think it's your son, Peter, right?
It is. That's my son, yes.
How old is he?
13.
So younger than your students. But there's a kind of fear of the future here, you know, as if we are slipping into this way of being, becoming something new, something other than yourself virtually, you know, taking the sort of shortcuts. But it feels kind of inevitable. Does it to you?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly seems that way. That seems to be how it's unfolding, that we are moving into this technology more and more and moving into virtual worlds. For me, I think part of it is right now a bit of resistance that's needed. So, for example, calling people instead of texting, leaving the phone home and then going for a bicycle ride, and then creating communities and going out and being part of a community garden or something like that. I think that's the what's required in some ways to retain our humanity and our communities.
Well, in this future, there are a couple stories. Migration, nobody goes outside. You know, only the people who are delivering groceries and products ordered online have to be outside. But then there are two others where there really is no technology, Heartland and Ice Age. What has happened to the Earth in these stories?
Yeah, those are the stories where I really take on environmental degradation. In Heartland, people are selling off their topsoil. And as I mentioned, that's really, I was thinking a lot about fracking at that point. I was also, that was the summer of the BP oil spill, where we were just watching, if you remember the news, where it's like, it's day 75 of the oil spill. It was just total dystopia on the news. I mean, it continues to be total dystopia on the news. But that made me so worried about, you know, the environment and what we're doing. And so I wanted to create a story that had that desperation in it, that had humans trying to be good amid a place where banks have foreclosed houses, the environment has been sold off. You know, again, now I'm thinking the Dakota Pipeline and the protests happening right there. It's the same story that's happening. And so while it's dystopian, you know, in many ways, our reality ends up becoming more dystopian than that story. In Ice Age, this is sort of post-apocalyptic where, you know, everything's failed and we had another ice age. And so the survivors have had to go back to living in these igloos and hunting, you know, and creating community. And then there's one guy, this one rich guy who's created the double-decker igloo, and he's burning up all the wood, right? So, and I was writing that around Occupy Wall Street, of course. And so there is that critique of, you know, the 1% and using up all our resources. And then the story hinges on this peacemaker that's trying to say, come back to the community. You know, we're working here together. And even though it's a rough existence that all the poor folks in the single-decker igloos are living, they're at least having a kind of community there, which is what's at risk again. And so the metaphor there is our own society, where if we don't come together, if we don't take care of one another, if we don't take care of the earth, we're really at risk of losing what is our humanity.
Well, it's so interesting in these stories that are sort of devoid of technology. After so many stories of being about how people are connected to not just their technology, but their technological reflections of themselves, you know, that the more they have this kind of this vision of themselves enabled by something else, the less they feel connected to other people. So,
right.
So it really isn't always the technology, but it's this human wish, this almost addictive wish to feed ourselves.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's right. I mean, that is the critique. It is overcoming. I mean, in many ways, there's a Buddhist strain that runs throughout the collection, which is overcoming our own sense of need for power, need for wealth, narcissism, all of these ego things that I think create a lot of the problems. And then a beauty of the human connection, of humanity, of caring for one another. I think a lot of the people in these stories are really trying to do good. They are trying to raise families well. They're trying to be good lovers, good parents, and understand what that means, good neighbors for that matter. And it's, you know, speckled throughout this collection are these good acts. Are people really trying? And that's what rises to the surface, I'm hoping, in these stories is that, you know, human connection is all there really is, I think, as one of the characters says in Children in the story, Children of the New World. And yeah, and stepping away a little bit from that, there's loneliness too, I suppose, which is why this human need for connection also comes from a sense of loneliness or a sense of needing other people. And that's the sweet part of the internet. I'm not completely against the internet at all. I think there's wonderful connections that happen because of it. But it also allows that loneliness and those needs to go a little bit unchecked.
So is this book or these stories a warning? I mean, not that the dystopian future will come from some grand puppeteer, you know, ruining things, but that we could be sliding down a slippery slope that we should maybe just think through a little bit.
Yeah, I do think of them as warnings in that way. That's the hope of it, is like, let's be careful, right? Let's watch out for what we're doing here. Is this the future we really want? Or have we lost ourselves to some degree? And how can we, you know, return to what makes us the best parts of humanity, of care for others, of checking our own egos, you know, so that we're not abusing or manipulating others, all of these kind of things. And that is both the warning and the hope that runs throughout there. Again, I try to, like, not put that too forefront because I think preferencing the characters and their conflicts and being careful of any kind of moral agenda that I have as an author, I really want to be careful of that lest I use my characters and I step on them as soapboxes, right? So I think I'm also always undercutting my own philosophies in there. Like, I may have a moral that I want to work towards, and then I hope my characters will somehow show me what I'm missing in that, you know, because I want my characters to be much smarter than I am in some ways, you know, or at least teach me something that I don't yet know.
Alexander Weinstein, author of the new short story collection, Children of the New World. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
You can find more on the book, including some amazing reviews, at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today. Music in this episode came to us from Franco Luzzi, David Seste, and Jason Leonard. Much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. We're also on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio and on Twitter at Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, back tomorrow at 2 here on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Molly Donahue,
Logan Shannon,
and Jimmy Gutierrez.
Our senior producer is
Taylor Quimby,
and our executive producer is Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.